to publish one and to be out in the world with it. In writing it, what inner critic, what was it, the inner critic in your own, within yourself, that you had to deal with in writing this memoir?
I have many inner critics. I think everyone does. Who really needs real critics? We've got this chorus, Greek chorus of people saying things. In fact, I do a workshop that I teach called Embracing the Inner Critic, where I ask people to go outside and come back in disguised as their worst critic. And then someone in the class plays them. And we have a psychodrama. And here's an example. One man who was a minister, he decided that his inner critic was called Umberto Perfecto, who was a Renaissance man and, of course, did everything brilliantly and perfectly. And he would criticize my poor student for being a procrastinator, for being not very smart, for really having nothing to say. These critics say these things. And we then would be with the creator, and we would talk back to the critic. And what usually ends up happening is some sort of agreement between the critic and the creator, that the critic will let the creator have a little more slack, because the critic will be given some sort of job or some sort of respect, because usually the critic is trying to protect you. So to answer your question, the critic for this book, because I have different critics for different books, for the National Geographic book, it was something like, well, you're not going to be scientific enough, you know. Dun, 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 you know.
Yes.
The critic for Build Me an Ark was, you're not going to do justice to these other species. You need to be a translator. And so you can see how those critics might have helped me, even though they were a little, you know, strident at times. But the critic for this book was much more intimate and frightening, I would say, because it said you're going to lose your family. And if you don't have a family, what do you have? I have incredibly close friendship bonds that are like chosen family and chosen sisters and chosen brothers. And even madres and padres, you know, elders. But that critic would stand there. And unfortunately, that critic had a lot of help from the real world, because the minute the first chapter was published, about a year before the book came out, which was in Orion, which is the prologue, about sitting on the beach with a man who's my neighbor who believes in the rapture, and having this tender, humorous, and middle path conversation about the end of all things. The minute some of my family read that, it became a kind of poison pen circle. So for a while,
so the telephone was ringing and they were talking to one another and really getting together kind of against Brenda. Oh, Brenda's doing it again or something. Yes. What would be the voice?
There she goes again, you know, exposing us and laughing at us and just basically, why would you write this book? Why would you look at this religion that we hold so dear and laugh at it? And I said, you know, I laugh at myself as well. And I think that humor is the highest degree of intelligence. When you look, have you ever seen a stand-up comedian who was a fundamentalist? Have you ever seen a fundamentalist stand-up comedian?
I don't believe I have.
I don't think so.
I don't believe I ever have.
I don't think so.
Now, maybe our listeners can write in and say, there are some, but I haven't seen them myself.
It doesn't. Fundamentalism and that kind of my way or the highway is not gray or humorous enough to invite that kind of scrutiny.
Or even with environmentalists. I mean, you know, we're in a county here where things are felt very, very directly as far as the environment goes, and there's a way that you just cannot. You've got to be really serious, and if you're not really serious, then you're not really understanding the problem. So, but there is a way to understand the problem and be light about it.
Yes,
maybe that's my feeling, and I think it's healthier in some way. It doesn't mean that it doesn't dismiss the problem, which is real.
It's a mature way of looking at life. As I said, as I grow older, I have more of a sense of my divine comedy. Joseph Meeker, whom you all interviewed years ago, who has written a book called The Comedy of Survival, I really took that as my kind of Bible for this book, because he talks about what comic characters do, or picaresque characters. They basically are like animals. They just adapt. They take evasive action. And if worse comes to worse, they change, right? So change is what fundamentalism fears the most. I mean, think about it. Fundamentalism is going back to some fundamental truths, whether it's Islamic militants or Christian crusaders. You have this idea that in the past it was perfect and we have to go back to that. And we don't adapt and change and go into the future. So I think that if you really want to look at a sense of humor and take it everywhere, whether you're at a PETA convention or you're at a rapture convention, having a sense of your own fragility and your own humility and your own comic path, I think really helps a lot in negotiating whatever you have to negotiate.
Going back to what you were saying about your family when they read the first chapter in Orion magazine and they were getting their guards up, and you were talking about, you couched it in a way like, well, how could she be talking about us? And this is one of the things about a memoir. When you are really writing a memoir, you're writing about people you know and people you've had relationship with. And as you said, this is your family, and your greatest fear was maybe I would lose my family. That was no small thing, I know, for you. So I'd love to hear you, what you have to say to others about writing about your family rules, outing your family rules, or outing your family laundry, so to speak. What about that?
Every family has secrets, and every family is afraid of the person who's telling the story. So right there you have that critic inside and outside. My agent, Sarah Jane Freeman in New York, said to me one time when I was really having a hard time writing this, kind of trying to stay in the eye of the hurricane, she said, "Brenda, you can either be a writer or you can go home for Thanksgiving dinner." I haven't been home for Thanksgiving dinner. I probably won't be going to the next reunion. But I do have some parts of the family who are championing this book. You know, like I said, it's a very diverse family. And my brother read every word of this book in manuscript. And he really helped me because he considers himself a conservative Christian. He's a military man, very different worldview from mine. He once quipped to me that he thought he might have more success negotiating with Islamic militants than with this family. So that shows you some of the extremes that we're dealing with. But I did not lose my brother or his children or his wife. I haven't lost my parents. I have to say, my respect for my parents has grown immensely in the way they've stayed above the fray and have practiced a kind of loving equipoise with all of the rest of the family. And I didn't know that they might do that, but they are becoming elders. And that's what elders do.
Right. Well, even before that, you write about how you gave this graduation speech with another person at your high school in Berkeley in the late 60s or early 70s. Maybe it was the early 70s.
Late
60s by then. I mean, you're right in the heart of it. And of course, you're going to have this rebellious sort of speech. And people walked out. But what did your parents do?
I think they felt a kind of protective fierceness toward me, even though they didn't agree with anything I was saying. We took the text from the Beatles song, "She's Leaving Home." Well, you can imagine how that would seem a little bit in your face, you know, when we are leaving home, actually. And it was Berkeley, and people were just rioting for nothing, basically, and rioting for every reason, because it was a Vietnam War, and people we knew were dying, and other cultures were dying. So even though I was completely at odds with my family being anti-war and sitting in on train tracks and stopping munitions trucks and things like that, my parents, they are believers. They're patriots. They believe in the freedom of speech. They may not like it, but they believe it.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So I want to talk about some of the mentors that you have met along the way, and there were many of them that you came to revere and helped you. So let's talk about some of them. Let's talk about, like, first of all, Mr. Dunmar, or
my symphony director, Mr. Dunmar.
You play the clarinet, I believe. And what did he teach?
He was our director. And this was a big epiphany for me about fundamentalism, because my family are beautiful singers, and Irish tenors and beautiful descant singers and sopranos. And when I went into the symphony to play the clarinet, and it was a very good Virginia State symphony, we were playing Tchaikovsky and all sorts of very difficult things. And one thing Mr. Dunmar kept saying, because we were in the middle of integration and civil rights, 64, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 64, our school was being integrated, it was chaos. I went from being one of all white basketball girls team to only white girl on the basketball team. And what Mr. Dunbar said, I'll never forget, he said, "Oh, we've been integrated. It's all the missing parts of our symphony that are now here."
That was beautiful.
He talked about blend and listening and how we really had to find a way to understand opposite points of view and hear counterpoint as part of the greater theme of music.
And this is what you say. You say that your family speaks four languages, and one of the languages
is music.
Is music.
Yes.
And so no matter what, when you break out in song, you are listening to one another and the harmonies, and
yes,
that's such a beautiful gift.
And we all still sing.
And you do.
In choirs, I'm in a chorale. My brother was in a pretty serious band for a while. Mm-hmm. And what happens is we'll be in the middle of a huge fight at dinner, and my father will say something kind of like, "Well, let's not have roast people for supper," you know, because we'll be gossiping or something.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden someone will bring up the hot spots, global warming, abortion, healthcare, you know, you name it, Iraq war, whatever. And then we all just start in. And then someone, at one point, I think I said in the book that we were having this huge abortion debate, and in the middle of it, someone started singing, "There is nothing like a Dane." And we just all fell into the musical and started laughing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think singing is a great way to dissolve, like humor. Singing, humor, taking evasive action.
Exactly. I'm here with Brenda Peterson, and she's the author of I Want to Be Left Behind, Defining Rapture Here on Earth. And her website is iwanttobeleftbehind.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Peterson. And Brenda, there was a moment that I really appreciated in your book where you talked about working as a waitress in North Carolina. And you, and I identified with it because I worked in a cotton mill in the South with people. So I really identified with this story and about how you got kind of unionized in a certain way. And then you ended up in someone's home and you learned something so deep there about empathy and your own perspective and moving your own viewpoint around from being this righteous, let's get more pay for more work for this work and so forth. So talk about that, because I thought that was profound.
That was just in 1972 when I had graduated. I went back to the Pisgah National Forest. My father got me a job as a waitress, and it was the mountain people that was their only source of income, and in very poor Appalachia. And we worked really difficult hours. And I thought, let's form a union, because these people are getting paid nothing. We're working like slaves. And so we met, and we had these kind of 60s-like union leftist kind of meetings, and I organized them, and some of my other friends joined in. And we had this wonderful strike for more benefits and for some sort of pay and some time off, because we had no time off. And we all got fired and escorted off the mountain by the state patrol. And because I had no place to stay, I had to go stay with one of my other waiter and waitress friends. And we went into their house, which was a shack, and no running water and no electricity. And I realized that night that what was just a political statement for me, because I was middle class and could go home, was a heartbreak for them, because they had lost the only wage earner in the entire family of about 10. So I began to realize that you can have beliefs and you can have political persuasions and religious beliefs, but really, what do they cost if there is that kind of loss? I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't rise up when there's injustice and there is a cost for everything, but I saw that I had done it as a rather callow young woman without understanding that my righteousness had consequences.
And that's what I see over and over in your book, that you were able to see another perspective as things went on, and that's where it is. You also quit your job. This is now early on. You quit your job at a very prestigious job, although your work was not that prestigious within it, but with the New Yorker. And you quit the New Yorker, and you went to a farm, a five-acre farm in Colorado. And so talk about the difference between being in this elitist magazine and then going to Colorado.
I was downwardly mobile. What can I say? I had landed at the age of 21 at the New Yorker magazine in the editorial department under the great William Shawn editor, with the great writers there. Rachel McKenzie was the fiction editor, and I was in hog heaven. I mean, for a literary person who wanted nothing more than to write and to read, I had arrived in heaven. I had been raptured to the New Yorker. And I began to see that it had its own fundamentalism and its own dogma and its own quirks, and they were bigoted against anything that smacked of... I was writing a Southern novel, so my character spoke like my grandmother, who speaks like, it's rain, pissing like a flat rock, it's rain like a devil, whooping his wife, and she's a-crying up a storm. Well, you can't
see that. You even had still your Southern accent.
I did, slightly.
And they kind of frowned. Didn't someone say...
They said, you're going to lose the accent. You'll sound stupid. Of course, they had Brooklyn accents, but that doesn't sound stupid. So again, I had the lesson of the one who doesn't fit in. Mm-hmm. And if I had stayed at the New Yorker, as some of my friends have, I would have a lot more prestige and power. But I don't think I would have become the writer I have become today.
Yeah.
So I do not regret it. Sometimes my bank account regrets it. Sometimes I think, what an idiot I was. I could have stayed in the epicenter of literature. But I write a whole chapter about the New Yorker, and it was my apprenticeship to writing. But
you did make a really good friend there. She with Rachel McKenzie, didn't
yes.
you? She really mentored you. That was yes. that was one of your mentors.
And I acknowledge her in every book. She was the person who discovered Isaac Bashevis Singer, and she also edited Peter Taylor and Philip Roth and Muriel Spark. And she was the one who said, just write what's in your heart, even if it's not popular. If you keep writing from your heart, someday people will hear you. And she offered to edit the book, which was thousands of dollars worth of work, and I accepted it, of course. And then she got me to Knopf, to Judith Jones, the legendary editor there, who did Julia Child and John Updike, and is in that movie now, Julie and Julia. So I was very lucky to be mentored. And Rachel said something that I will never forget. She said, the only thing that matters is kindness. It doesn't matter what people believe. It doesn't even really matter sometimes what they do. All that matters is kindness.
And that really comes out in your family over and over again. There was a moment when you were in Georgia with your father looking out the window, and you had a mystical experience with a mountain lion, and he was there too. So tell us about that.
That was in California.
Oh, it was
right
in California.
Here in California.
Oh, I missed that. I thought
we went to Georgia next.
Uh-huh.
But you have cougars here, you have mountain lions here, and I was on the cusp of having to leave home and maybe not coming back because they were moving to Georgia. And I desperately wanted to stay in the University of California, and we had an encounter with a cougar who came into our backyard, and my father came up behind me, and I was so afraid he was going to call, because he is in the Forest Service, I was afraid he was going to call animal control. And he just looked and he said, not many of her kind left. I think we'll just keep this to ourselves.
That was a very special moment, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Because he shares the same love of nature that you do.
Yes.
This is a bond that is so strong.
Yes. Yes, and he taught me. And in a way, I think people have been saying in the reviews that it's a love letter to my family. We all try to write love letters of various kinds to our families, and some people can receive the love, and some people can't. My parents seem to be able to receive it.
Yes, and so now going back to the time when you're in this little 5-acre farm that was inherited from
my great aunt and uncle.
And so it was kind of your Walden, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you met another person there that was very helpful, a Native American.
Who reminded me of my grandfather, who is Seminole and French-Canadian.
Yeah.
His name was Mr. Vail, and he was a corn farmer, maize. In fact, that's going to appear in Mother Earth News, this piece about farming corn. And there I was, going from the New Yorker magazine to this podunk little place, dirt roads, and no one could understand it. I mean, people would write me letters, come back, there's still a job, you know.
Did you understand it?
I just stood in the cornfield at night under a full moon, watching the water like silver rivulets, and listening to what Mr. Vail called the green music of maize. And I stood there, I didn't need any explanation. I was grounded in the earth. I was rapturous in the earth. And no prestige or no amount of money or no nothing could compete with that. And I think those of us who are gardeners and those of us who have our own place in the natural world, you certainly here in Ukiah, it's so beautiful here. That is a kind of rapture here on earth I want to celebrate,
mm-hmm.
because there's so much grim stuff, and there's so much, poor children are learning so much about endangered species before they even meet other species,
right.
And they're traumatized by it.
Exactly. We're running out of time, and there's so many other people that I'd love for you to talk about, but one that we'll go out with is Maud. She was someone who you met going down the Colorado River,
yes.
And she taught you something really profound, didn't she?
This memoir is a tribute not only to my family, but to all the mentors who came to me at certain times in my life when I was losing my way and just said, consider this. And Maud, I was in the Grand Canyon going down the mighty Colorado, and she was dying of kidney failure. And And she was on this incredibly rigorous trip. And every night we would sit around and we would talk very frankly about her death, about what was next. And at one point, I'll remember this, we looked up and you saw these millions of stars and you're so deep, there's no electronics. Princess Di died while we were down there and we didn't know. You're just on the river, on the river. And we were down there, it was very, very still. And she said quietly, "I'm so curious about what comes next." She wasn't in a hurry. She wasn't fleeing or escaping. She was just wide open and curious. And I was in my 30s, so I was much further away than I am now from the end of my life. And the grace and the curiosity and the musing quality of her relationship with her own death gave me a buoyance about my own life.
What a gift, what a gift. Brenda, it's just been my pleasure being with you today. Thank you so much for gracing our studios.
Thank you, Justine.
I've been speaking with Brenda Peterson. She's the author of I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. And if you'd like to be in touch with her, you can go to her website of the same name, iwanttobeleftbehind.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3343.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Douglas Brunther, author of The Quantum and the Dream. Next time on New Dimensions,